This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dennis Smith, is a retired New York City firefighter who's now an honorary assistant chief of department. He's also the author of the bestseller Report from Engine Company 82. On September 11th, after the second tower of the World Trade Center was attacked, he walked to his neighborhood firehouse in Manhattan and went with the firefighters to Ground Zero. He arrived just after the second tower collapsed. He kept returning to Ground Zero to work in the bucket brigade that was clearing the debris searching for human remains. Now Smith has a new book called Report from Ground Zero that includes interviews with many police and firefighters who were in or nearby the towers at the time of their collapse. I asked him what he was able to do when he arrived after both towers had collapsed.
Well, there wasn't really much to do. There was people walking over the piles, yelling out names and that kind of thing, trying to find any survivors. You know, it's in the experience of the fire department that in a major collapse like this that you will find survivors, because the way buildings collapse, generally speaking, there are a great many voids that are left in the building. You know, for instance, when a wall gets cantilevered over, and there is a big spaces where human beings will fall or get trapped or whatever, but they would still be alive. And this is common in earthquakes, for instance. But here, you know, there were 15, 16 survivors that survived the collapse itself. And there were 14 in the North Tower and 2 in the South Tower. And when I got there, the one in the South Tower had been rescued and the other one was about to be rescued. And the 12 that were trapped in the North Tower were still trapped. Now, hardly anyone knew they were there, of course. And then finally, when they made radio contact, and they made radio contact in a very interesting way, Billy Butler called his wife way upstate New York, and he told her, well, look, stop crying, because you have to do something, you know, call the firehouse, have somebody in the firehouse go over to the site and tell them that we're here and we're alive and that we're on between the second and the fifth floor of the North Tower. And, of course, the second and the fifth floor, what at one time was the second and fifth floor, was no longer that. It was just, you know, another sort of mound in a pile of rubble. And the firefighters finally found them about 4 hours later. And they were taken out, and they came out of their own accord. There were a couple who were pulled out from, two men from Engine 39 who were pulled out from the first floor. And they were pulled up a height of about 30 feet.
Did you interview the man who had phoned his wife while he was trapped between the second and the fifth floor?
I did. I talked to all of those, just about all of those people who were trapped in the North Tower. I talked to the people who were trapped in the South Tower. A man named Wilhelmino, whose friend Dominic Pizzullo died before his eyes in a course of 4 hours. I mean, he hung on and he hung on, and then finally he expired. Both of them were completely trapped and immobile. And so I went to Wilhelmino, and he told me that story. I went to the chief of department, who was Dan Nigro, and Dan Nigro took the place of Pete Gansey, who was the chief of department who had died in the second collapse. Dan Nigro had driven across the Brooklyn Bridge with Pete Gansey, and they talked. You know, Gansey was the chief of department, and Nigro was the chief of operations. And of course, what they saw before them was the most extraordinary thing. I mean, in our experience, to see one floor of fire in a high rise building is quite a job. To see two floors would be a major alarm, but here they were looking at 7, 8, and 10 stories on fire in the middle of the World Trade Center. So coming across the bridge, Dan Nigro just said to Chief Gansey, he said, Pete, this will be the worst day of our lives.
Let's talk a little bit about what faced the men at the top of the command who had to decide what the strategy should be for dealing with the towers as they burned before they collapsed. You interviewed surviving members of the command. Were there many men who had survived who were there from the beginning, or was it only people who came in later who you were able to talk to?
I talk about Joe Dunn, the first deputy police commissioner. And Joe Dunn was going to work. He got to the site just after the first plane went into the North Tower. And when he got there and got out of his car, he happened to be on crutches because he had snapped his Achilles tendon some weeks before. And he's a very big man, Joe Dunn, very well respected in the police department. I mean, maybe, you know, one of the most respected police officers in America. And he got out of his car on his crutches, and just then the second plane hit the South Tower. And when that second plane hit, it literally went through the building. And so so much came out the other side. I mean, planes, engines, part of the wings. And a huge amount of debris was thrown, showered, to the north side of the building. And Joe Dunn literally ran to get under building number 5, which had a sort of an overhang, which was just east of the North Tower. And while all of this murderous debris, went all around him. So he just saved himself there. At the very same time, part of an engine fell down into the courtyard between the two towers, went through the courtyard, and went into the bottom corridor of the World Trade Center, the one corridor that connects the two towers beneath the ground. And there it trapped John McLaughlin, Wilhelmino, and Dominic Pizzullo of the Port Authority Police Department. Now, few people know that, actually, that that collapse in that basement occurred with the crash of the second plane going into the South Tower. So all of these things were happening at once. And Joe Dunn then went to the command center of the Office of Emergency Management, which was in building number 7. Now, this is the building that, of course, collapsed at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And they couldn't get in there. They got into another building where the mayor was, and the police commissioner and fire commissioner had gone there. And then that group of people decided they were going to go to some other building to create a command center, and then they ended up in a firehouse up on Houston Street. Joe Dunn decided that he would go back with his men. And so he, with his crutches, went back to the fire scene, to the scene of the collapse. And the first building had collapsed, and he was down in the street. And his, staff kept saying, "Hey, boss, we got to get out of here. You know, this building." He said, "No." He says, "I got to make sure. Let's make sure all the men are out of here." And his car was parked down the street in front of the North Tower, and. And then finally, a bomb squad truck passed by, and one of Joe's staff stopped the truck. They literally pushed him into this truck with his crutches, and the truck began to take off. And as it took off, the second tower came down. And had that truck not gone by at that moment, Joe probably would have said, "Okay, you're right, we got to get out of here," and they would have gone to their car, which was... a car was found 2 weeks later in the Staten Island dump, and it was completely incinerated and crushed, and they found Joe Dunn's sunglasses. And I tell this story, it's just an incidental story, but it gives an idea of the ruination there, that they found his sunglasses in the glove compartment of his car, and he was very finicky about his sunglasses, and they were expensive, and he was concerned about them. And when they found them, they sent them back to him in the metal case, completely burnt. And the sunglass lenses themselves had melted down into little BBs. And that's where Joe would have been, in all probability. had that bomb squad truck not come by.
My guest is retired firefighter Dennis Smith, author of the new book Report from Ground Zero. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Smith. He spent 18 years as a firefighter in New York. He's now honorary assistant chief of the fire department. He's also the author of the bestseller Report from Engine Company 82. Now he's written a new book called Report from Ground Zero, in which he interviewed many of the people of the fire department from the command on down who were there on September 11th. Let me ask you a kind of general question about skyscrapers, and granted there's never been a catastrophe in a skyscraper like there was on September 11th, but when firemen get to a skyscraper fire, what are some of the things they have to keep in mind that make skyscraper fires different than any other kind of fire?
Well, the most fundamental consideration is how many floors of stairs do you have to walk up? Because you're carrying equipment, and that always is a challenge, just walking up the stairs. So that's the first consideration. The other is the water supply, and you have a standpipe system at the bottom of the building, which you feed into, and you put the water in the standpipe system. And your fundamental consideration at any fire, whether it's in high rise or not, is the life issue, life safety. Who is trapped? Who is above the fire? How do you get them out? Have they been trained? Have they had fire drills? These are all the kinds of considerations that are made.
What about things like fear that the elevators might collapse and plummet to the ground, or a special kind of like air shafts and wind tunnels that might form?
Well, this was a great consideration in the World Trade Center. There were several people who were burned in the lobby of the North Tower, and they were burned because as they were walking into the lobby, a huge amount of burning aircraft fuel came down the elevator shaft and blew out into the lobby and burned a group of people pretty significantly. And the elevator shafts themselves can, in a fire, act as a flue. You're right in thinking about that. I guess, Terry, it'd be intelligent to explain to you the architecture of the building to help you understand that this building was built, if you think of a straw and then square the straw some way, and then that each floor was attached to the sides of the inside of this straw. And through the middle of the building itself was a shaft, and in this shaft were the elevators and the stairwells, the three emergency stairwells. And that gave the architect a huge amount of space to use, you know, usable or rentable or sellable space. And that is, of course, the mission of an architect, is to try to build a building with as much, you know, economic usable space as possible. And in a building this size, normally you would get 50% of the floor space usable. And here, with the design that Yamasaki made when he designed this building, he got 75% usable space. And the 25% was used in the middle of the building with the elevators and the stairwells.
How did that affect how the fire spread?
It affected it greatly because when the plane came in, it went through this middle column of the elevators and stairwells. And so that immediately cut off the stairwells for any kind of escape, either down or up. I mean, these people couldn't get to the roof either because the fire was coming right up the stairway shafts now. And so that was a flaw in the design that they didn't recognize was flawed when they originally designed it, in my opinion. And it also enabled, because there was no structural steel supporting this anywhere except for around this middle column, it allowed those floors to pancake so that when the first floor fell to the floor beneath it, the floor beneath it could not sustain the weight of one falling floor with the dynamic and, you know, weight of the fall. And then that, of course, led to a pyramid collapse, one after another after another.
What are you taught about when you're training to be a fireman, about when you go into a burning building and risk your life, and when it's just too risky and you don't, you know, you just don't go in knowing that you're going to be killed?
Well, I think that what you're taught initially is that you have to trust the experience of the person next to you, your lieutenant or your captain. And if that person is bringing you into an environment that's, you know, by definition is pretty hostile, if he's bringing you in there, your chances of being safe are pretty good, because his experience would have brought you there. And the reason I make that distinction is that the captain of one of the engine companies where several firefighters were lost is a woman and very well respected in the New York Fire Department. So you have to trust your leaders, because they're the only people who've been inside enough burning buildings to get a sense of what will happen. There are the academic understandings, but sometimes they don't serve you so well. For instance, the fact that steel stretches at 1,200 degrees inherent temperature is an academic understanding of the physics of fire, but it didn't help anybody knowing that in the World Trade Center, because of the way this plane came in, a plane that normally travels at 350 miles to 400 miles an hour comes in at 550 miles an hour. It is loaded with fuel. It has 24,000 gallons of fuel. It creates a comprehensive fire load on the floor. It heats the steel up comprehensively at every edge of the building. And when the steel buckles, the steel all stretches sort of simultaneously, and it creates this pancake effect when it finally collapses. No one ever thought that. There's no precedent for it. And now we know. We didn't know that before.
The firefighters were treated as heroes by all of New York and by all of the country as well. When you became a firefighter in the late 60s, you weren't always treated as a hero when you showed up to fight a fire. I mean, to the contrary, sometimes the firemen were treated as the bad guys. Where did you work, and what was the climate like there?
That was, I became a firefighter in 1963, and I worked in what was then the busiest company in the city of New York, Engine Company 82, which was in the South Bronx. And, you know, the world has changed so much since then. This was in the burn, baby, burn period of our history. There was extraordinary racial unrest in our inner cities. The politics of the nation was in turmoil because of the war in Vietnam and because of the advent of the civil rights movement. And the manifestation of these things in our inner cities was pretty horrendous. I mean, we responded to 40 alarms a day, and we had two or three or four major fires every single day, and people were burning up their buildings because they felt that burning the buildings were better than living in them. And it was a political statement as well as anything. And when we got there, very often people would throw things at us and so on. But, you know, I don't feel any hostility toward those people, even looking back, because it was truly a part of the times. And firefighters suffered because of it. But yeah, it's a dangerous job anyway.
What kept you going then, fighting fires, when you were sometimes showing up at fires that were intentionally set by the people who lived there, and the people didn't want you to put it out, the people didn't like you or respect you necessarily when you showed up?
Well, you go to these scenes as a unit, as a company, with people that you know and respect and trust, and that you've worked with. And so you do your job in accordance with the history of how these units work with each other and within the group. And so, your obligation always is to go into that unit, no matter how many people are outside throwing stones at you. And the first thing you do is search for somebody who might be trapped above the fire or in the back room or whatever. And if that person is unconscious and or just recently expired, you know, you get on your knees and you give that person mouth-to-mouth resuscitation under any circumstances. And that's how we worked. And firefighters work pretty much the same way today. They are extraordinarily respected today in a new way, because no one ever realized before the nature of going into a building that everyone was always running out of.
Well, Dennis Smith, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Dennis Smith is the author of Report from Ground Zero. He's a retired firefighter who's now an honorary assistant chief of department. This is Fresh Air.